So it's good to be back. It's been quite a few months since I last was here, I think in August. I've traveled and taught in four other states and been away quite a bit, so it's good to be back here and to be here 2 weeks in a row and to explore a theme that we'll stay with for 2 weeks. So my intention is to focus on that theme tonight, also next time, and give some ways of practicing during the next week so we can explore and come back next week. I like to, as you know, work that way. And so the theme that I want to explore is that of going into the dark. And that's chosen in relationship to the time of the year, this dark time. And I want to explore what it means to go into the dark. I'm going to bring out, I think in the course of our time together, bring out six metaphors that help us to explore what it means to go into the dark. And this is really using the earth and the way that the trees and the forests and the mountains are at this time of year in the Northern Hemisphere. That is, they are going into a period of less obvious activity, less blossoming. In a sense, it looks like they're stopping. And it's also, of course, a time of greater darkness, moving up to the time of the greatest darkness on the winter solstice in 12 days from now. So I want to explore the theme of going into the dark in ways that we can make use of in our own lives, in our own practice. The first is going into the dark as, like the earth, in a sense, stopping, being more still, stopping more. And the second aspect is another metaphor. It's going into the dark as going into what's difficult or challenging. A third meaning of going into the dark is that we go into the unknown. We hang out with the unknown, sometimes with what's even, we could say more strongly, mysterious. And the fourth theme, which I won't look into so much today, maybe next time, is going into the dark as going into the shadow territory of our being. More the psychological language of going into what we don't acknowledge or recognize in our own being. The fifth is going into the dark as generative and fertile, much like the earth being. When it's still, nothing seems to be happening, we know it's preparing for spring. Working really, really hard beneath the surface. You can't see the little plant gnomes doing their work, but they're there and getting ready. And so that further metaphor is going into the dark as going into what is ultimately generative, fertile, productive, we might say. And then the last sense of going into the dark, which I probably also will look at more next week, is going into the dark as that which produces light. The dark as luminous. And so maybe to start with the first one, and again, what I want to do is explore these, hopefully inspire you to take on a practice, and it may be related to one of the themes we look at today. So you may want to, in the next period of time, have a period of stopping, not being so busy, or be with what's difficult, or be with what's not known. So I'll explore that, and I'll explore and try to make clear how these can be guides for our own practice in the next period of time. And it's a very suitable time for being with the dark. And of course, so many cultures in the Northern Hemisphere, the winter solstice has been a very crucial time. You know, cultures all over the earth really have found the winter solstice a very important time. It's connected with the mystery of how there are cycles, of how there's darkness, and then out of that, there's light. And I think earlier times, people weren't quite sure that we'd get light again. And they felt they had to help it along some. Right? So they would have these ceremonies of the coming of the light. So there were winter solstice ceremonies of the native peoples of this area that would go on sometimes for several days. You know, it's a natural time to stop and to reflect on what's important and reflect on how things have been and how they might be. And some of you know that the famous stones at Stonehenge were designed to be set so they would be coordinated with the sunset at the winter solstice. That's how Stonehenge was designed. And of course, in our time, when the invitation from the earth and from most other cultures is to slow down, take stock, reflect, don't be so outwardly busy, what is often the case? The opposite, right? Often can be the busiest time of the year for many of us, even though probably we get a few days somewhere. But you know, it can be very, very, very busy and speedy, right? And especially if you have to get 35 different gifts for people. Anyone have to get 35 gifts? 15? Yeah. And so the first meaning of the sense of going into the darkness is stopping. And you can see that the meanings of going into the darkness are mixed. Some of them are a little more neutral, some of them have to do with difficulty, but some of them are quite positive. So we really go against the tendency sometimes in our culture to just see dark as negative, right? So we have the dark ages and so forth. And we've, you know, in so many cultures, darkness is associated, whether it's in India or in the United States, that darkness is sometimes associated with dark people who are less than, right? So the metaphors are loaded in many ways. So I think it's helpful to use a range of metaphors of darkness that are not just negative, that are not just pointing to what's difficult. They point to the range. So the first sense of this time, is this a time where we can, like the earth, stop and have some stillness to reflect, take stock? So can be really, really crucial to have a period like that. And some of us have that more naturally. I love that for most of the last 35 years, I've been able to be on retreat quite a bit, a lot around the time of greatest darkness. And I, along with my colleagues John Travis and Heather Sundberg, we started a retreat at Spirit Rock about 12, 13 years ago that we called the Winter Solstice Retreat. We noticed on the calendar there was nothing offered around the winter solstice. We thought, oh, people will be too busy. Maybe we'll get 20, 30 people who come. With capacity at Spirit Rock being 90. We weren't sure because we thought people would be too busy, but we actually have had a full retreat every year this year the retreat filled up in August, within 2 weeks of registration. So the encouragement here is, can you take a time and be like the earth, to stop? Give yourself a few days. You know, I know one of the things that I don't remember doing here, when I first came out here, I was I helped form a local group in Berkeley, where we formed a local sangha, where we met in people's houses every morning and meditated. And we did this for the better part of, I think, a year and a half or 2 years. And we rotated around people's houses. All of them were within 5 minutes of each other. And we rotated, and we would meet in people's houses, like, I think, you know, probably 8 o'clock or something like that, for whom would work. But we also, around the New Year's, we did like a 3-day retreat in someone's house. It was wonderful. And of course, none of this was involved money or anything. And we, it was very wonderful just to have this informal way. And so consider that. Find a time just to be quiet. You may want to meditate, read, be with the earth, and so forth. Can you do that? Can we be like the earth with the darkness and stop, find more stillness, use our meditative practices to let the mind wind down, be more quiet, come to less busyness of mind with our practice? That would be one invitation. Do you have something like that scheduled? If not, consider it. Consider having some quiet time. The poet Rilke was really a poet of darkness. And I wanted to read a poem where he talks about darkness. He says, "I love the dark hours of my being. My mind deepens into them. There I can find, as in old letters, the days of my life already lived and held like a legend and understood. Then the knowing comes, I can open to another life that's wide and timeless." So you have both dynamics, that there can be this stopping, but then also the stopping can be productive. In a sense, we could be paradoxical and say, we need to stop in order to keep moving well. You know, we need to be still in order to later to move. So we have these ways of stopping, of being still, of coming to silence. All of these are great powers for touching something deeper in ourselves. You know, not even, you know, sometimes we just do that. I know often when I do my own retreats, I really have to just say, I don't know what will happen, but we trust in a way something to come that will be helpful. Like another part of a poem from Rilke, "All creation holds its breath, listening within me, because to hear you, I keep silent." So that first aspect of being with the dark is finding a time to stop and be still, be silent like the earth. And the second metaphor is to be with the difficult. To be with the dark is to be able to be with the difficult. And this is really a central part of our practice. I would say one of the great glories of the practice that we do here, the mindfulness, the work with the kind heart, the development of wisdom, one of the great glories is that we have resources, perspectives, and tools to work with what's difficult. I mean, I think before I practiced, if something difficult happened, I just threw up my arms and said the equivalent of, "Hallelujah, help me," or whatever, or just did something very habitual, you know. But here we have this way, something difficult occurs, and we have tools and perspectives. Pretty amazing. And it changes everything. There's a more advanced teaching that we occasionally teach called the teaching of transcendental dependent origination, which is the counterpart of dependent origination, which is what the Buddha came to on the night of his awakening, which is essentially about the roots of suffering. And the transcendental dependent origination is about the roots of freedom. It's the opposite trajectory. And interestingly, the first step on the path of freedom is when we have a different approach to difficulty, to what's called in the text dukkha, or suffering, or reactivity. Something difficult happens, we have a different relationship to it than our habitual relationship, and everything changes. What's our habitual relationship to what's difficult?
Push it away.
Our habitual relationship is to wish it wasn't there, try to get rid of it in one of a number of ways. And that's the counterpart of our conditioned reaction to the pleasant, is to grab hold. The very fundamental teaching, when there's something pleasant, we grab hold of it if we're not aware. When there's something unpleasant, we tend to push it away unconsciously, automatically. And when there's something neutral, we tend to space out. And we can do that in all sorts of ways. The pushing away can happen when we have something difficult physically happening. We don't want it. We can tense in the body. And this is related to the teaching, which I've often given here, the teaching of the two arrows, where the Buddha says, what is the approach of someone with practice to the something unpleasant or difficult being present? And his answer was, usually when we have something difficult, and that could be something difficult physically present, something difficult emotionally present, difficult thoughts, difficult interactions with others, something unfair or unjust, we typically, the Buddha said that first difficulty is like the first arrow. It's like being shot by an arrow. He says we tend, because of being shot by an arrow, to shoot a second arrow at ourselves or someone else as if that would help get rid of the first arrow. So that we call that reactivity. So when there's something difficult physically present, we would tense or blame ourselves or blame someone else. If I have just stubbed my toe because my partner left something that I tripped over, I blame my partner. I shoot the second arrow at my partner. If I have something difficult happening, I might blame myself. Those are all examples of the second arrow. If I have something difficult physically happening, I can tense in the body. And so what we learn to do in our practice is to see all the different ways we shoot the second arrow and not shoot it, but find alternative ways to be with what's difficult. That's the habitual way we react. It's also the way that groups of people react. Like most wars or conflicts, if you look at them, are two people or two groups shooting second arrows at each other. So this is both, guidance for individual practice, but this could be guidance for peacemaking. And I like to interpret the nonviolence of Gandhi, King, Dorothy Day, and others as exemplifying exactly the same teaching. We have received pain, oppression from others. We will not simply give them pain and oppression in return. But we will do something different, but still respond really strongly to what happens. So this is not about passivity, but it's a question of how do I act with difficult when difficulties are present without simply reacting interpersonally, towards myself, in a group. So this is actually, I think, the core of the entire teaching of the Buddha. It's right in this teaching. And what we develop are a number of different ways to explore this. And learn how to be with the unpleasant or the difficult and not simply push it away or not simply react or not simply blame ourselves or wish it wasn't happening or whatever. You know, so we learn skillful responses, such as learning sometimes when we can be mindful to watch the mind when it's blaming or judging or reacting. We can watch the mind, and sometimes when we watch it enough, we learn that we're just following some pattern that we learned 10 years ago or 30 years ago. And if we see it enough, we can say, oh, I don't need to do that. That's why when we're being present with difficulties, we actually have to sometimes hang out with them a lot. I like to say that we don't put this in our promotional literature. When we advertise for meditation, we say, come, learn to be calm, peaceful, develop an open heart, develop wisdom, which does happen. Those things do happen. But if we're giving more accurate account of what you actually experience in meditation, we would say, come. Develop a little bit of calm, and then watch your neurotic patterns for the next 5 years. Become experts on your bad habits. Sit with unpleasant physical and emotional states more than you thought you would when you signed up. I once looked at the promotional literature for Spirit Rock, and it doesn't really do what I just said. I think that would be truth in advertising, though. You know, and again, there's cycles. Sometimes when we stay in this, we really experience more the wonderful, beautiful, powerful, the kind heart, compassion, wisdom, seeing into great insights, personal, and the nature of human beings. But sometimes we sit with difficulties, don't we? My experience was initially that I had enough peace and calm and wonder that I got sold on the program. And then the difficulties came. Right. So anyway, you get my point. So there's this really important capacity, and some of us may want to take as a practice for this next period of time, can I be with difficulties? You know, and can I be with what's challenging? It could be relationships. And what would be some guidelines for being skillful with difficulties, you know, whether they're physical, emotional? One initial guideline is to know the level of intensity of the difficulty. I say this a lot, right? That very crucial to know the level of intensity. And sometimes some of our difficulties are on the overwhelming side, or they're too difficult, right? They're overwhelming for us. We can't really be mindful of them. Then we have to have in our repertoire ways of coming back to balance when things are too hard. You get really, really upset with a family member around the holidays, right? And you're just really out there. Right? And if someone said, be mindful, you would say, forget it. Right? So what do you do then? We have to have in our repertoire like a few ways that when we're a little bit out of balance, we can come back to balance. So it could be, you know, the usual ones would be, take a walk, be with beauty, be with something that inspires you, talk with a friend who can kind of talk down a little bit. There are meditative practices, working with the heart practices like loving kindness or compassion can be wonderful for difficult states when you've developed them enough. Sometimes you can reflect. So each of us need to have almost like a little piece of paper that we carry around, carry it to family gatherings in the next few weeks. And when the intensity is too high, bring out your list and say, I am out of balance. What should I do? Okay, look on your list and choose the appropriate strategy. Okay, so that's the first guidance with difficulties. Sometimes the level of intensity is within a range where we can be mindful. Then, really great to be mindful of the challenging situations. Be mindful of difficulties, really crucial. And like I said, to hang out with them a lot. Be with the mind, be with the challenging thoughts in relation to a relative, family member. Study what your mind does. A further tool is to bring in the heart practices, loving kindness or compassion. To do those enough so that they're there for you, because we want to hold our difficulties with a kind heart. Even if we're being mindful, we need to bring in the kind heart in ways that work for us. To hold the difficulties so partly we know it's not the only thing happening. That we can bring kindness. And then, of course, we need to, it's a whole separate area, we need to have a lot of skillful ways to talk to people when we're having difficult experiences. How do I talk to people when I'm triggered, when I'm reactive or upset, right? Again, I would give the guideline of tracking the level of intensity, and if the level of intensity is such that we are out of balance or overwhelmed, better not to talk. In the 7th century, great text by Shanti Devi said, when the level of intensity is too high, be like a bump on a log. Don't say anything or do anything. Right? So that's, hopefully that will save some suffering. Right? And then we need to develop skillful speech, which I won't say so much about because it's a whole area. But I love when Oren and I teach retreats on skillful speech. We have a lot of fun because we do the fundamentals the first two-thirds of the retreat. And then the last third, we do role plays with people doing difficult situations. How do I talk skillfully with this difficult situation? And the role plays are so much fun. So if you have a friend, you can do role plays with your difficult situations. So the Zen teacher John Terence says, the courage with which we bear our own darkness frees others from having to carry it for us. There's also the sense of being with the dark as being with the unknown or being with the unresolved. Does anyone here have anything unresolved in your life? Raise your hand. Okay. About 20% of us have something unresolved in our lives, so one of you could be the speaker next week if you have nothing unresolved, because I have unresolved things in my life. Okay, so what we could do in the next week is we could really have a conscious approach to what's unresolved, especially that which is on our minds. Can I be with the dark in a skillful way? Can I be with the unknown? Can I enter into an unresolved issue or just something that I don't know? I don't know how it will turn out. Can I do that with wisdom and with compassion? And that's what this third metaphor is really pointing towards. So we're thinking about qualities of openness, of spaciousness, of listening, of not knowing. Can I have an emphasis on really listening carefully in the next week? I like the Tibetan beloved hermit, Milarepa, is often portrayed with his hand to his ear, listening to the sounds of the world. And listening is a beautiful metaphor for being open, for not knowing. Can we bring more of that in the next week? Can we bring more of that quality of not knowing? Or I think of Kuan Yin, the goddess of compassion in the Chinese tradition, she who listens to the cries of the world. Listening, very, very special. One way of working with not knowing is to bring in the perspective of mystery. Maybe this part of my life is mysterious. Can I open to mystery? And we can do this also very much in our meditations. We can, at the beginning of a sitting, say to ourselves, I don't know what really will happen. How many of us in our meditations sometimes just try to get that nice, calm, peaceful feeling and sort of manipulate our body and mind so we kind of feel calm and peaceful? Anyone occasionally do that? Okay. It's quite common. Could we actually have a radical attitude of not knowing at the beginning of meditation and say, I don't know what will happen? Some of you who have been on retreats may do this, because when you're doing a lot of meditation every day, the routine of trying to make something happen can get a little old. Right? And so we can really have that aspect of, I don't know what will happen. Let me be open to the mysterious. And we can do that in our lives. Let me be open to the mysterious this day. Say that in the morning. What would that be like? Can I really have that attitude of openness, of mystery, of not knowing? There's a beautiful passage from Rilke as well. Some of you know from the collection of letters that he called Letters to a Young Poet. Has anyone read the Letters to a Young Poet? It's a beautiful text. And Rilke, when he wrote this, Letters to a Young Poet, was like 29. He was old. And the young poet, I think, was 20. So he called this Letters to a Young Poet. And the young poet was wanting everything to be worked out at age 20. And Rilke basically counseled him to have a kind of openness. And this is from that letter. He said, have patience with everything that remains unsolved in your heart. Try to love the questions themselves, like locked rooms and like books written in a foreign language. Do not now look for the answers. They cannot be given to you because you cannot live them. It is a question of experiencing everything. At present, you need to live the question. Perhaps you will gradually, without even noticing it, find yourself experiencing the answer some distant day. So another aspect of this not knowing is to live a question. You know, like in Zen practice, you work continually with a question. That's interesting, isn't it? That attitude of openness. Because how many of us feel like we have a conditioning that I need to know? A lot, right? So a lot of us have that, right? So, you know, as I'm speaking, listen for which of these metaphors resonates the most with you, that might guide you, that might inspire you in the next week, that maybe to stop, or to, they could do more than one, to stop, or to be with difficulty, or to be with the unknown. And it can be quite wonderful to do this, and to be with the unknown, and to have this sense of, I don't know when it'll be resolved. You know, there's a wonderful story that I like from the life of Gandhi. At one point, was not sure what to do in the Indian independence movement. This was 1929. And he was just not sure what to do. And people around him were saying, tell us what to do. And he said, I don't know what to do. He said, what do you mean you don't know? They said, what do you mean you don't know? You're Gandhi, you're supposed to know. And he said, I don't know. And he said, I'm going to wait till I get the answer. And so he sat on the veranda of his house, on the porch, the front porch, we might say. And his home was overlooking a river. And he sat on the porch for weeks on end, not knowing the right direction for the Indian independence movement. And he said, people would come to him after 2 weeks, 3 weeks, tell us what to do. And he said, I don't know what to do, but I know that if I listen long enough, I will hear what to do. He had that faith that something would come to him. After 6 weeks, something came to him. And he said, I know, we will march to the sea and we will make salt against the British law that it's illegal to make salt from the sea. Because the British wanted to keep the monopoly on making salt, which was at that time when they didn't have refrigerators, was crucial for preserving food. Crazy, right? The British from this little island, like how many thousand miles away, they come and say, you cannot make salt from the ocean where you live. Crazy, right? But Gandhi, they started out marching from his home with 250 people. By the time they got to the sea, there were 10,000 people. Maybe you remember that from the film on Gandhi. It's in that film. And they were met by brutality by the British, from the British, and a lot of brutality, and over weeks and weeks. And a lot of historians say that was actually a turning point because the British brutality was more than it had been in the past, and they were in a way discredited internationally by that salt campaign that came out of not knowing and waiting and listening. Can we do the counterpart of that in something important for us? And then the last one that I want to talk about is the darkness as generative, as fertile. This is like the earth that is, right as we speak, getting ready for the spring. All sorts of stuff happening beneath the surface. And can we see, much like in that story of Gandhi, that the not knowing as darkness was generative, actually pivotal for the Indian independence movement? Can we see how being in the dark in these different senses, how stopping can be helpful, how being with difficulty can be fruitful? Can we look at that? Can we know that being with the dark can be fruitful, generative, helpful? That the lack of knowing can lead to knowing. That being with the difficulty can bring learning. One person in who comes on Wednesdays at Spirit Rock likes to say, another effing growth opportunity. Beckons, right? But that points to the fruitfulness. Oh, this is going to be one of those learning experiences. I'll say, oh, it's so good after it happens, but right now. Right, so can we be with that and have that perspective? Again, from Rilke, I believe, he says, I believe in the night. From Rumi, some nights stay up till dawn, as the moon sometimes does for the sun. Be a full bucket pulled up the dark way of a well, then lifted out into the light. And this is from an activist named Valerie Carr. Breathe, or breath, labor, push. She's talking about the collective darkness that we're in right now. Breath, labor, push. What if this darkness is not the darkness of the tomb, but the darkness of the womb? What if our America is not dead, but a country waiting to be born? What if the story of America is one long labor? What if all of our grandfathers and grandmothers are standing behind us now? Those who survived occupation and genocide, slavery and Jim Crow, detentions and political assault. What if they are whispering in our ear tonight, you are brave? What if this is our nation's great transition? Breath, labor, push. So we can have that sense, maybe knowing in our own experience, that there have been times when there was difficulty, darkness, not knowing, and something fruitful came out of it. That's helpful to remember. Or I was thinking even of my father was blind the last 35 years of his life. And he probably went blind from being a scientist, a chemist, working for the government and having bad ventilation with some chemicals for a whole summer. That probably led to his blindness. He was not bitter about that. He did not speak about that, but he was blind. And as his outer sight left, something seemed to happen with his inner sight, and there was a greater heart and greater warmth. There was a certain fruitfulness from not seeing, not being preoccupied, you know. The sense of sight is so powerful for us, right? And having that not be there, he would be a very good listener. And there was, I think, more kindness. Something developed that wouldn't have happened otherwise. Very interesting, isn't it? And I think also of in many cultures, it's the blind who are wise. You know, I know in ancient Greece, there was the figure Tiresias in some of the Greek myths. And he was the figure of wisdom. He was blind, right? So can we see the darkness as fruitful in certain ways, in the sense of difficulty or not knowing? Can we see that stopping as fruitful? So let me just end with a poem. And I'm gonna have some more things that I can bring in next week. I was one of the areas that I've taught on some, which is really interesting. I think I'll bring in next week. I've taught some on what's called the dark night of the soul, which is more from Christian tradition, but it's very powerful. So this is a poem to end from Pablo Neruda. I think I've given this here before, one of my favorite poems. If each day falls inside each night, there exists a well where clarity is imprisoned. We need to sit on the rim of the well of darkness and fish for fallen light with patience. We need to sit on the rim of the well of darkness and fish for fallen light with patience. How many of you would like to focus in some way on one of these themes of darkness in the next week and have that guide you? How many of you would like to do that? Okay. Once you see, what's a good way to do that for yourself? Whether you raised your hand or maybe if you didn't. What's a skillful way for me to focus on one of these themes of darkness and light? And let me take some time now for any questions or discussion points, reflections, stories. We'll use the mic. Could be, if you want to, tell a story of some time that something was unresolved, you stay with it and something came out of it, or some way that difficulty led to something fruitful. What comes to mind? I have some more poems.
Being silent. We've chosen stopping in silence.
Okay. Now all of you who raise your hands are saying, okay, I'm going to be silent. Okay. Not having questions is fine. Because it's the unknown, right? Okay. And then you'll be second.
It's really rather a minor difficulty, but it was... I spent most of my morning last Friday, somebody had been hacking into my AT&T account and different things, and I had to go to different vendors and correct things, and I came upon this lovely man who not only helped me with the part he was responsible for, but also helped me with another device that he could have just been like the first vendor and said, that's not me, mm-hmm. go to them. And we got to talking, and I said, "Oh, where are you? He's in Nicaragua, and his name is Juan." And you know, it was, we just had kind of like a little connection there.
Yeah, out of a difficult experience.
And so I came away from that 3 hours of, you know, trying to put my life back together. I think, you know, this is almost worth it.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, what we especially want to look for is when something difficult happens, watch the narrative that's saying, this is bad, nothing good will come of this. We want to especially watch the story we tell ourselves. This is would be an example of shooting the second arrow. Like when I work with people, the most common guidance I give, something difficult has happened, watch the tendency to shoot the second arrow. One way to do it is to make a narrative, oh, my day is lost, nothing good's going to happen today. Watch that tendency, it's very common. We can watch that and say, okay, I see it, I'm going to let you go. That is a very major way to work with this. Yeah, thanks. So right, two rows behind.
Yeah, I was thinking related to...
A little closer to your mouth.
Oh, a little closer, yeah. It's just simple, but there are times when I have insomnia. I wake up at 3 in the morning, and I lay around in bed, and I ruminate, my mind goes, and I try to get myself to relax. And then just, okay, well, I'm going to get up and sit, and I'll either fall asleep or I'll get a good long sit.
Right.
And I'm sitting with sometimes an hour and a half.
Yeah.
And just one time in particular, you know, just letting the anxiety and the thoughts just emerge and feel them. And it felt like a substance at a certain point just drained out of my body, almost like a toxin.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know about the brain and deep sleep and all that.
Yeah.
But, and then it was just like letting go and just simple, but it was... empowering to see I had the agency to actually...
To agency, not to be stuck, yeah.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I do actually something very, very similar. I have a guideline that if I'm ever up in the middle of the night more than 5 minutes, I sit up and start meditating. And it's like, so it's basically, sleep is good, meditation is good, whatever happens, good. But I have that guideline of 5 minutes. That's an important one, so I don't, you know, because a lot of times it's... Right. Yeah, thank you. How many do something like that? Yeah, that's great. Hi.
Hi. The first thing I want to say is when you talk about darkness isn't always bad, the first thought that came to my mind, especially this week, was dark chocolate is good. But on a more serious note, when I go frequently every 6 weeks now to Florida to visit my mother, my sister is her primary caregiver, and I feel like I'm walking voluntarily into a very loaded, delicate, difficult situation.
Yeah.
And the last time I was there, I practiced listening. And instead of engaging my sister in dialogue, I let her have her, I was going to say tirade, but I'll say monologues. And I just practiced listening. And I didn't respond at all, which was so out of character for me and threw her totally off base. But I've made a promise to myself that it's much more productive to just be in listening mode.
Yeah.
And hear what she's saying. And keep saying, I hear you, I understand, I hear you.
Yeah.
And not be defensive and not put my argument out there and not give her a counter argument. Just stay with, I hear you, I understand.
Yeah, wonderful.
And it really helped me cultivate gratitude for her. Even though there's friction, there's constant friction, there's a lifetime history of friction.
Yeah.
I can cultivate gratitude for what she's doing for my mother in the midst of really being angry and being attacked. Listening was transformative.
That's great, I think, and what I'm hearing, you didn't use the word empathy, but I think really, you know, sometimes when people go on tirades or whatever, but if you can take a radical practice of listening with empathy, you know, what's beneath, as it were, the tirade, or what matters for that person, there's always something that matters, even if the person is unskillful. And to listen with empathy like that is a beautiful practice, and sounds like that was very fruitful. And it doesn't resolve everything, but it helps a lot. And just have the inner freedom to do that and not have your own mind be compulsive, it says so much, right? And also thank you for the comment about dark chocolate. Yeah, I think, how many of you prefer dark chocolate to light chocolate?
Well, I was on a trip about a month ago with a number of people, and we were, in a situation where we would eat dinner together, all of us, the six of us.
Yeah.
And one of the people, a lady who I didn't really know well, but I knew, and she was like in the early stages of Alzheimer's. And so we would have dinner conversations, and she would ask the same question five times.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
Yeah.
And my inner being wanted to scream at her and said, you've asked this question. We're all sitting at the table, and it's going to be for hours on end. And the inner being wanted to scream at her, and I can't stand that you ask these questions endlessly, we
yeah.
already answered it.
Right.
And I mean, the only thing that helped me in that difficult situation is to absorb it and to try and absorb it as best I could.
Yeah.
And not say a word and let it just happen. And it was, we were on this trip like for 16 days. And so, every day I at dinner, I didn't look forward to dinner because I had to struggle so hard to try and absorb this and know that it wasn't. I mean, this was not intentional, and she was not trying to put anybody on or anything. And it got a great appreciation for people who take. For caregivers,
yeah.
With this day in and day out.
That's right.
So, I mean, it was useful, like, in the sense of appreciating how difficult it is for people to take care of people who are in that situation.
Yeah. No, it's a really good example for bringing what we've been talking about, bringing a sense of practice, because, again, first thing would be notice what's the, as it were, the habitual reactive tendency is just to tell, don't you know what you're doing? Or don't, this is reality, right? Or whatever you would say. So you could watch your tendency to be reactive and you don't go there. And maybe before you practiced, that wouldn't have happened, right? You wouldn't have had enough mindfulness to notice the tendency. And then you have some other strategies, and you could just, could say, I guess this is the time for compassion practice the whole time I'm with her, as it would be with, I think I'm gonna have
just
to...
I want
to
add one thing.
Yeah, well, be brief, because I was wanting to finish up so we can go to the meta cards. Okay, but we may have some time afterwards, but sorry to cut you off, but I was... Yeah, so just we could work in those ways. And if we have time, we can come back to you. But let's do the meta cards.